BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
There are moments when the big assumptions you've made about the world around you suddenly dissolve. The fall of the wall in 1989 was one such moment of total change. The events of the last month, all originating in the new administration in the White House, feel like another. All that was solid about NATO and European defence, underpinned by the US alliance, seems to be melting. Things are moving fast, but underneath it all is one central question. What would it take for Europe to assume its own defence, including guaranteeing the survival of Ukraine? Step into the briefing room and together we'll begin to find out. First, a reminder of how we've got to this point. I'm joined by the BBC security correspondent, Frank Gardner. Frank, can you take us up to Monday's announcement that the US was pausing aid to Ukraine? How did we get there?
Well, I think this goes back to the Munich Security Conference, which I had the privilege of reporting on. I mean, it was really a huge, big wake-up call, cold shower, whatever you want to call it, for Europe, because that really was the final realization for Europe that America no longer has their back in terms of defense security cover for Europe. It's not necessarily abandoning them. Nobody is saying that it's leaving NATO, although Elon Musk has said he thinks it'd be a good idea if America did pull out of NATO, but America is still in NATO. But nevertheless, the message there was very clear that there is now a transatlantic rift, and that rift extends to the animosity clearly on display on Friday night, last Friday night, between President Trump and President Zelensky, egged on, of course, by his vice president, J.D. Vance, which was just the most extraordinary theatrics. And you only had to look at the Ukrainian ambassador who had her head in her hands. I think one of the things about Trump presidencies, plural, is that they're not only very transactional, but they're also very impulsive and emotional. So it's clear that Donald Trump has a visceral dislike of Volodymyr Zelensky, but also his warmth that he feels towards Vladimir Putin. It is a complete 180 in the previous geopolitical order of things that we had up until January the 20th.
One of the things that seemed to be reiterated was this idea that the Americans had been giving a lot more money to Ukraine during the war than the Europeans did. To get an idea of the gap, can you tell me how much the US has been spending on Ukraine compared with the EU and maybe some of the other countries that have been supporting Ukraine as well?
The US is unquestionably the largest single provider of military and financial aid to Ukraine as a single nation. But if you take Europe as a whole, Europe's contribution has been very slightly more than the United States.
Who in Europe is spending most on defence now?
Per capita, Poland, followed by the Baltic states. The further you get away from the front line, the less in percentage terms they spend. Spain is less than the 2% mandated by NATO. Germany is only just inched over the line. But very recently, Germany's Friedrich Merz has announced that they are going to be investing huge amounts, hundreds of billions of euros, he's even talking about. I mean, a massive uplift in defence expenditure. Because Germany has, for the last few years, been underfunding its military, as indeed has Britain and many other countries, because the so-called peace dividend, which was a very valid concept when the Berlin Wall came down in 1989, it isn't just about percentage numbers. People agonise over 2.3, 2.5, is it 3, is it 5%? What matters is the effect you're trying to deliver. And the biggest problem for Europe, it isn't money, it can find the money, but you can't get away from the fact that Europe doesn't have the industrial, military industrial capacity to churn out the kind of defensive systems and ammunition to match the Russian threat.
Just looking at the spending, how much more would European and other countries have to spend roughly to make up that shortfall?
I mean, tens of billions of dollars stroke euros, without question. They wouldn't be able to make up the shortfall. That's the bottom line. This can't be done with the United States. If Trump does not reverse the suspension of military aid and the war goes on longer than another 3 months, which it's perfectly possible, Ukraine is going to be in big trouble.
If we look at the UK, we have these recently announced increases in defence. Can you remind us from what to what and by when?
OK, so Sir Keir Starmer has been under pressure for quite some time to raise Britain's defence spending from 2.3% of Britain's national wealth, its gross domestic product, to 2.5%. That is, I'm not going to use the word laughed at because there's nothing funny about it, but that is dismissed with scorn by military experts, saying it doesn't even touch the sides. There is a huge shortfall in certain programmes. Britain has the, you could say in financial terms, the added disadvantage that it is a nuclear weapons power. And so the nuclear deterrent, what's known as the continuous at-sea deterrent, our Vanguard submarines that patrol deep under the waters of the North Atlantic, that comes out of that defence budget. So it doesn't leave an awful lot left. So in a way, we're competing with other countries with one arm tied behind our back.
So nuclear takes up a fair bit of the budget as it is. And there are plans to raise it beyond 2.5% now.
Yes. So the aim is for it to get up to 3%. But it's what you do with it. And here I think it's important to say that there is an important bit of work taking place as we speak. The Strategic Defence Review, headed by Lord Robertson, George Robertson, who was Tony Blair's Defence Secretary and later NATO Secretary General. The idea is to look not at what we've got in the coffers, but what the threats are, what the challenges and needs are. There are a lot of things where there are shortfalls. The British Army is now down to, what, 72,000? That isn't 72,000 fighting troops. We would struggle, I think, to put two brigades into the field, you know, in Ukraine, which is roughly 7,000 or 8,000. But let's be clear on this. When Sir Keir Starmer talks about sending boots on the ground and planes in the air to Ukraine, that can only happen if Putin agrees to it. We're not going to be sending troops into harm's way, into a hot battle zone, because that simply invites World War III.
Yes, yeah, so we should be clear about this indeed. Those troops are only going to go there as part of a peace agreement that's already been agreed with the Russians to secure it.
To offer some reassurance to the Ukrainians. But even that, in the unlikely event that Putin does a 180 and says, even though in the past I've always said no to NATO member countries having troops in Ukraine, my friend Donald suddenly made me change my mind. This is a tiny force, and you've got a 600-mile-long line of contact between Russia and Ukraine. They're not going to be able to police and patrol all of it. There is one point that we shouldn't overlook, which is the message coming continually out of the White House is, look, you don't need US troops on the ground in Ukraine to act as a deterrent to President Putin. The presence alone of US mineral companies, mining companies, digging out Ukraine's critical minerals will be enough of a deterrent. The Ukrainians don't think so. And if you look at what happened in August 1990 in Kuwait, there were US oil companies operating in Kuwait. Saddam Hussein still invaded. That was no deterrent to him. And, you know, Putin's going to do what Putin wants to do. He has not given up on his maximalist aims of bringing the whole of Ukraine back into Moscow's orbit. Of course, he doesn't want to clash with the Americans, especially now he's got Donald Trump in the White House. But the Ukrainians say he's broken the Minsk agreement, he broke the Budapest memorandum, he is not to be trusted.
Frank Gardner. And before we go on, just a quick reminder that you can subscribe to the Briefing Room podcast by visiting BBC Sounds and you'll get access to the entire back catalogue, which includes the one about why our prisons are so overcrowded and the one about what tariffs are and what happens when you increase them. Now, time to dig into the challenge facing Europe and its capacity to meet that challenge. I'm joined by Shashank Joshi, Defence Editor at The Economist, Fenella McGurty, Senior Fellow for Defence Economics at the International Institute for Strategic Studies, and Claudia Major in Berlin. She's head of the International Security Division at the German Institute for International and Security Affairs. Fenella, how big a challenge is Europe facing now?
I think it is an extensive challenge. I primarily focus on the financing side, looking at defence spending across Europe. And we're really talking about significant fiscal pressures across the region. Defence is not cheap. And unfortunately, Europe came into this vastly complex strategic situation after a period of, frankly, widespread underinvestment in defence. And what we've seen really is a kind of scramble over the last 2 years to get to the point where we should have been, had there been persistent, consistent increases for defence that were funding capabilities.
So are we saying that essentially the fiscal planning of all these states has been based on pretty low levels of defence spending?
Absolutely. It's been a period of looking at cost savings and efficiencies across Europe, and that has impacted industrial production as well. So as we saw countries try to get to various benchmarks of spending against GDP, it really required difficult decisions elsewhere. And we've had this period as well of recalculation of what defence actually means and what spending elements can be included in the defence budget. So now we've gone through that recalculation period, it's starting to bite in other areas. You either have to increase debt levels, increase taxation, or make public spending cuts elsewhere.
Claudia, how would you characterise the size of the challenge?
I think I would characterise it differently. If you look at the last 3 weeks or the last months, we have seen an end of the transatlantic relationship as we knew it. We have seen an American president who decided to take an antagonistic position to Europe and to Ukraine, who prefers to team up with Russia, and who apparently seems to leave the democratic liberal camp and to join the autocratic one. So we see the end of the transatlantic relationship as we knew it. We see a reinforced, emboldened Russian revisionism. And that means for us Europeans that we have two problems in the same time. Russia that wants to dominate Europe and the US that is turning away from Europe and the transatlantic relationship and probably the Western models. And we have overall globally a change of global order that is driven by military force. And that is a totally different frame than the one we used to operate with. And the result, the consequence of that is what Finella just outlined. That's the pressure to invest more in military defense and in total defense. That means not only military threats, but the whole hybrid gray zone that reaches from cyber to disinformation.
Shashank, can we separate things out for a moment and just take Ukraine on its own? Is it inevitable that without US support, Ukraine will lose this war?
Without US arms, ammunition and intelligence, Ukraine's battlefield position is going to deteriorate. It will lose more territory. Russian advances will accelerate. And the rate of Russian losses will fall while the rate of Ukrainian losses will grow, compounding the problems that I've talked to you about on this show before, such as deeply understrength brigades. Now, war is not linear. Ukraine will start rationing ammunition to try to slow down the consumption rates. It will start defending particular bits of the front, accepting losses on others. But over time, I fear that the current trajectory will get worse and worse without any American support. And that while Europe can offset some of that loss, Europe cannot offset it entirely. And therefore that I'm afraid I haven't got any good news about the long-term trajectory without America involved.
So there's a double challenge, Finella. There's the immediate Ukraine crisis. There's the longer-term European security response. Who's taking the lead in Europe on saying we need to craft a new response and what that new response might be?
I think we're seeing leadership from countries like the UK, France, and now increasingly Germany, I would say. But I think it's also interesting seeing the initiatives being led at the EU level with Ursula von der Leyen's announcement around EU fiscal frameworks being adjusted to enable greater increases for defence. And that really is part of a raft of efforts underway to try and mobilise more and more funding for European defence. But I think, again, bringing us back to the fiscal pressures, it's always been an element of concern that these increases to defence are coming at a time with wider pressures in terms of demographics and climate change mitigation. So if we're enabling countries to increase deficit and debt levels further, then the IMF was already quite concerned about the fiscal position of a lot of countries in Europe. So these moves, while necessary for a lot of countries to enable increases for defence, do create real questions about the fiscal sustainability and economic health going forward.
Claudia, the German position in this is really interesting, not just as the richest country in Europe, but because it's always had the toughest fiscal rules. Can you take us through how that might be changing?
It actually changed. It changed on 4th of March, to be very precise. We had elections end of February, and in the moment, the two parties who are likely to form a coalition and the new government, the Conservative and the Social Democrats, made a joint announcement. And they announced that all expenses in the German defense budget above 1% of GDP will be exempted from the national debt brake. And that's a huge step. It means there's literally no ceiling for the defense budget. And the second big decision was to set up a special infrastructure fund to fix our outdated infrastructure. It will also be exempted from the debt break, and it has a volume of 500 billion over 10 years.
Claudia, sorry to interrupt, but could you just explain very briefly what a debt break is?
It means that the state cannot spend more than a certain level. And it's the so-called black zero that the German government has to respect in its budget. And it has so far limited investment in several areas. And what I found fascinating was a recognition that something in the European and global security environment has so fundamentally changed that Germany is ready to change its constitution. And Germany doesn't change its constitution lightly.
Fenella, just a very quick question. I remember from the old days of the Soviet Union, because this is how old I am, that it used to be described as the upper Volta with rockets. In other words, the idea was it had a lot of military force, but it had a relatively poor economy. Can you just remind us what the size of Russia's economy is compared with Europe?
Well, I think in terms of Russian economy, it seems like it's more in line with not even, you know, Germany or UK level. It's more kind of Italy and Spain levels of size of the economy. But again, there's always this issue in terms of Russia, where when you look at comparisons with Russia and look at them in USD terms, the volatility of the ruble.
US dollar terms.
US dollar terms. The volatility of the ruble and actually the plummet in value does somewhat mask what Russia is able to afford. And this is certainly applicable to defence, because when you consider the fact that Russia doesn't depend largely on other countries, definitely not the US, where there is dependence in Europe on some US kit. So you can consider how much Russia is able to afford in purchasing power parity terms, where the defence budget looks like it's quite small, certainly in relation to what European spending is. In purchasing power parity terms, it's far higher. It's almost three times higher. So that is why Russia is able to fund the near full spectrum of capabilities. It's why they're able to continue funding this war.
In other words, their economy is so set up that they can actually afford a lot more military stuff than we can.
Yes, a lot more domestic.
Shashank, can we just now turn to this question of this European deterrence force, since this is the thing which is currently on the table, or seems to be. Let's just take the UK for a moment. What kind of position are we in to make that contribution? And then beyond that, what position are we in to increase our troop numbers, our military strength, for the longer-term security of Europe?
I'd say a ropey position. It can be done, but it would stretch our army thin. We could deploy a single capable, combat-capable brigade, but what I always say is that it would suck up so many of the support capabilities that the army has. For example, engineering capabilities, logistics capabilities, electronic warfare, all of that would be poured into enabling this relatively small force inside Ukraine. And of course, you need to have forces that are outside the country, training, resting, recuperating, preparing to rotate in, because these are not indefinite deployments. So the UK can do that. The big problem isn't can we generate the force necessary, it's can we generate the force necessary and still meet our other commitments to NATO, including to Estonia and the promise of a reserve corps to the Supreme Allied Commander Europe. And the NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte is saying, look, it's OK to take some risk in that regard. You can draw down your reserves for Ukraine. But I think many frontline countries are concerned about the impact of diluting NATO defences in order to resource a serious force inside Ukraine.
Shashank, forgive my ignorance. Roughly how many soldiers are there in a brigade?
Perhaps 5,000 or so, depending on whether it's a light infantry brigade, an armoured brigade. But we're talking, you know, roughly in the region of 5,000 or so.
Claudia, do you think the Germans would be committed to providing troops for such an endeavour?
You know, we're in a particular situation in the moment. We still have a chancellor, but he's only he will soon leave office, and we don't have yet the new government. So I can't give you a precise answer. But if you listen to the potential new Chancellor Friedrich Merz, he has been very clear and that Germany has to play a leading role in Europe. So I expect a German contribution. But I think I would add some thoughts on to what Shashank said. In the moment, we talk about 40 or 50,000 troops. But if we are honest, the starting point in that debate is what Europeans have. It's not what in military terms would probably be required in order to deter Russia, uphold a ceasefire or monitor a ceasefire. Because if you look at what the Russians have in terms of forces in the region, it's about 600,000 or 700,000. If you look in the NATO plans, how we think about deterrence and defense, we take a ratio from 1 to 3. So if you have 600,000, 700,000 Russians, we would need a third, so 150,000, 200,000. If you include the Ukrainians, who would be the first line, as Shashank said, and then you add technical elements like drones or mines, you would still need a considerable force to uphold a ceasefire or to deter Russia. But we don't have it because our armed forces are very limited. Germany has 180,000. Norway has 25,000. And all our forces are in the NATO defense planning. So everything we put in Ukraine, we take it out of the NATO defense planning. So we consciously accept to take risk in the NATO defense planning in order to protect a non-NATO ally. That's the decision the countries have to take. And we also have a credibility issue because for the last 3 years, Europeans made a big effort to not be involved, to not put troops on the ground. So we have to make clear to Russia and to Ukraine that this force is credible. And many Europeans so far refuse to participate if there is not the famous American backstop, if there's not American intelligence, deterrence, and missile defense, targeting, all the things the Europeans don't have or don't have enough. So I think there's still a lot of things that needs to be solved. And the first thing that needs to happen is that Russia accepts a ceasefire, which I don't see because at the moment it works really well for Russia. And Ukraine is unlikely to accept an imposed capitulation ceasefire. So I think the first step is to get to that ceasefire and to put the force together. So I think we have still lots of work in front of us.
Is it your impression that Europe really believes that the US could indeed abandon it more or less altogether, Fenella?
I think there's still the underlying hope that there would still be some element of support and ongoing, at least diplomatic relations that would enable Europe to continue to fund defence, but also not depend on the US as much, but still see them as an ally. And the shift in messaging and the shift in mentality has been really important, and it really did have to happen. So that is one of the vaguely positive things to come out of the developments over the last month, is that Europe, the shift is there and it's spreading across more countries rather than a few making statements and initiatives at the EU level getting mired in nationalistic priorities. I think it becomes far harder to justify that kind of situation continuing, because Europe now needs to work together and make those increases for defence, but also look at different ways of doing it and perhaps working around or with the countries in the region that are perhaps not quite so minded towards that way, or potentially acting as a bit of a barrier to these kinds of initiatives. And I think that's kind of what's been interesting on the Germany front. When we looked at initiatives in the past, Germany could occasionally act as a bit of a barrier to certain initiatives because of their fiscal stance. So the shift in that mentality is remarkable in Germany. Now, without that as acting as a restrictive element, Germany can now take more of a leading role and enable or approve these very ambitious initiatives at the EU level.
Shashank, what do you think about this? I mean, I noticed that a senior Hungarian politician saying the other day that now Hungarians would only fight for Hungary. And I thought, well, you're a member of NATO. How does that sit with Article 5? Do you think NATO, in terms of Article 5, is practically over?
I put this to a European minister a couple of weeks ago, and they said to me, even if you think that, you should never say it. And I do understand that perspective, but I think in moments like this, we are in an emergency, and I fear that we are looking at an America that is not just aloof, not just detached, not just indifferent, but is actually actively hostile to many of us in Europe and our closest allies like Canada, threatening things that would have been unimaginable just 6 months ago. And so I think while it's difficult to say this, I do worry that this administration would simply not fight for Europe. it would not meet its Article 5 obligations.
I just want to row back a little bit. Let's imagine that Europe can actually stand in for quite a lot of what it loses if the US is withdrawing. If we were to talk about a timescale to do it, what might conceivably be realistic?
It could take, you know, upwards of a decade to even get to that point where you'd replace some of US capabilities across Europe. And it also depends what Russia's going to do as well. If in the event of a peace deal or ceasefire, what would Russia then do? Would it completely reorient its economy? Probably not. It would still keep production levels fairly high. Resilience and stockpiling had worked for them previously, and I don't think that mentality will shift. So for all that they've reoriented their economy, their defence industry, they're not going to immediately snap back. I don't think, for all that there's European concerns that a peace deal might not be this ironclad or long-term, Russia will also have that consideration as well. So it won't be an immediate snap back to peace.
Shashank, the figure put on that, it's an unfair question in some ways, that Fenella puts there, is a decade to get up to the level whereby you might make the Russians think twice before they are significantly aggressive again. What do you think?
I understand that, but I think it's based on NATO calculations that are assuming we want no risk, that we would be able to stomp the Russians with absolute certainty. I think we can do deterrence in a more clever and economical fashion if we invest in the right systems, long-range missiles, new technologies, focus on intelligence, focus on building up key gaps, working together more. You know, I think of, look at Israel. It spends a lot of its economy on the military, perhaps 6% of GDP, but it has astonishing capabilities. It's got the ability to operate aircraft and complex air operations on levels that Europe, no one in Europe is capable of doing. It's developed weapons that are world class and did so at a time when it was a relatively poor economy in the 60s. So I have to say, I think we have to be careful to avoid this kind of learned helplessness in Europe, that we just can't do it. It's, you know, it's too long. We can achieve pretty impressive deterrence within a few years with the kinds of sums of money we are seeing, as long as we think about it very, very carefully and cleverly.
That's all we have time for. My thanks to Shashank Joshi, Claudia Mayor, and Fenella McGurty. And my conclusion, well, in times of transition like this require clear heads and good leadership, and in these moments we find out who people really are. We'll be back next week. Goodbye. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Beth Ashmead-Latham, Kirstine Knight and Caroline Bailey. The sound engineer was Rod Farker. The editor is Richard Varden. Another edition of this podcast will be along again soon.
A billionaire Christian family is building a huge collection of artefacts for their Museum of the Bible in Washington, D.C.
During that time, there were 30,000 items, probably.
But a scholar-turned-super sleuth starts asking questions.
The magnitude of what I found out is incredible.
I'm Ben Lewis. I investigate the darker side of the arts and antiquities world, but nothing prepared me for this story.
Something truly, truly wrong was going on.
Looters, forgeries, and a scandal of biblical proportions. From BBC Radio 4, Intrigue, Word of God. Listen first on BBC Sounds.